I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed right now, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, the first being a brief conversation with CBS News journalist Wesley Lowery, formerly of The Washington Post and one of the regular contributors to 60 in 6, an offshoot of the award-winning 60 Minutes. Lowery recently traveled to Kenosha, met with the family of Jacob Blake, and also did one of the very first interviews with Rayshon White, who took the shocking video of the shooting of Jacob Blake that horrified so much of the world. The interview that Lowery did with Rayshon White is part of the latest episode of 60 in 6, titled We Need Justice, streaming on Quibi and available on Quibi's YouTube channel. Wesley Lowery, can you just say a word about the difficult challenge it is for a journalist to step into such a painful situation as the one here in Kenosha and speaking with those directly involved, specifically the family of Jacob Blake? What does that feel like as a journalist to, in a sense, step into people's lives in a way that you don't want to be intrusive and yet you need to speak with them? What are the dimensions of that challenge?
Oh, it's remarkably difficult, you know, and I think that a few things are true. You know, the first is the idea of parachuting in the first place, right? This is not a community I'm from, right? This is not my home. And so therefore, there is a need to do the requisite research and understanding that, as we know, all stories are local. There are unique individual histories of these towns, of these police forces, of these communities. And so first you got to start figuring that out. But then you got to show up and talk to people. And I've said this before, but journalists very often show up on either the best day of your life or the worst day of your life, right? You've won the Powerball or your son just got shot. And we knock on your door and we ask you a bunch of invasive questions. And I think that, you know, for me, when I knock on those doors, when I sit across from someone, I'm imagining that person as my uncle, my mother, my girlfriend, right? How would I want them to be treated? How would I best interact with them and build a relationship and talk? And I think that's a big part of it. You know, it is definitionally invasive. It's definitionally rude when someone's loved one's been shot to show up and start asking them a bunch of questions as a stranger. Hmm. But what we know is that for a lot of people, they want these stories to be out there. They want their loved one to be contextualized. In my experience, most people want to talk. It's just about approaching them the right way.
We have heard from Jacob Blake Sr. Expressing a number of different emotions, including understandable anger, as well as more recently his fervent insistence that there should not be the playing of politics over his son's life. And of course, Jacob Blake's mother very eloquently and passionately called for an end to the violence. As you sat down with the family, and I'm not sure exactly who in the family you got to speak to, did you hear, in a sense, similar voices, similar themes emerging from the conversation?
Certainly. You know, so I had the longest sit down and stay in contact with his uncle, but was there at the rallies and at the public appearances of Jacob Blake Sr., as well as of several Jacob Blake's sisters. And this family has been insistent from the very beginning, right? They want justice, and they want protest. They want demonstration, but they want peaceful protest and peaceful demonstration. That they, this is a family that has a history. That their grandfather and great-grandfather were relatively prominent ministers and activists. This is kind of a big Black activist family. And so because of that, both in Kenosha as well as in Chicago, and so because of that, there has been, Jacob Blake's uncle said to me, they picked the wrong family. We're not going anywhere. We're staying here. We're going to change things. And we've seen already them trying to harness this energy that as the president was in Kenosha, they were holding voter registration drives and community service events, right? This is a family that's pretty civically minded and civically engaged. And so it's been really interesting to watch them in this moment.
Did you find yourself able to ask any, let's call them, difficult questions about Jacob Blake Jr. himself? Not that any kind of wrongdoing in his life would in any way mean that he deserved the fate that he experienced. I mean, all of that is being unsorted. But in a moment like this, are any of those kind of questions even appropriate, or are those questions for another time?
No, I mean, look, I think those questions are appropriate. I did ask some of them. I didn't answer them, but I asked, and I think that asking is important. I think that it's hard, right? When we, having done these a lot of times, we know a few things, right? We know that the past of the people involved are going to be picked over and looked at, and in some cases it's going to be more relevant than others. We also know that, the court filings and docket searches can be limited. And we know that there are times where there are things that are inaccurate in there, things that don't stand up to scrutiny. So it's important to try to figure out what's actually true in some of these cases, and also to not make assumptions based on that, right? That I think one of the reasons there's such a focus on that past and that history is because people are attempting to project onto the current scenario. Mm-hmm. Well, because this was a bad person, therefore we can assume that we can assume the worst about what they did in this scenario, and vice versa. And I'm not sure that that is necessarily fair, necessarily always the most relevant. And so, mm-hmm. like I said, I think there's a delicate balance. As a journalist, as a reporter, you always ask the questions, right? Mm-hmm. You always ask the questions of, and you also sometimes respect if the answer is no, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to sit there and keep yelling at the dad, well, tell me about the warrant. Well, tell me about, can I ask the question? If he says no, we move on to the next question, mm-hmm. right? He's got the right to decline.
Your interview with Rayshon White, who actually shot the most notable video of this incident, was either the first or one of the first interviews with him. In a nutshell, what are some conflicted feelings that he has about capturing this awful moment and, in a sense, sharing it with the world?
Well, I think that he was one of the people, when I got to Kenosha, I wanted to talk to the most. Having covered a lot of these cases, I'm always interested in the people who are caught up in it, right? Rayshon White is not involved in this scenario. He's just a guy sitting in his apartment who hears a commotion outside, opens the window shade, and sticks a cell phone camera out of it. And as we talked, I spent a fair amount of time chatting with him. As we talked, what came through so clearly was the extent to which he really conflicted about everything. But look, he didn't think that this use of force is necessary at all. He was shocked to see, seven shots. But he also feels an anxiety and a responsibility. When he looks outside and sees unrest, he sees buildings being burned down, he sees this shooting where, this guy Kyle Rittenhouse shows up and shoots through the protesters, he's up at night thinking, is all of this my fault? What if I just hadn't posted this video? Would any of these things happen? Would these other people be alive still? And I think that is such a difficult thing for him to sit with. And like I said, it was one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to him, because I just think that dynamic is so interesting. You know, he didn't ask for any of this, and yet he's still dealing with some of the collateral consequences of that.
Wesley Lowery's interview with Rashawn White and the subject of his conversations with the family of Jacob Blake are part of the latest episode of 60 in 6 that streams on Quibi and on Quibi's YouTube channel. Wesley Lowery, thank you for your good work, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. Best wishes.
And of course, thanks so much.
You're listening to the morning show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two, we're going to be talking about a very intriguing new podcast that is about to be launched called Read More Plays, a podcast designed to help all of us better understand the world of theater, and more specifically, to better understand plays, the way plays are put together, and the amazing array of plays that are out there in the world, from beloved classics to out-of-the-ordinary oddities to cutting-edge new works that are redefining what theater means. This podcast, Read More Plays, is the brainchild of Jennifer Sassaman, who, of course, has been on the morning show any number of times to talk about the various plays that she has directed in recent years. She joins us along with her friend and podcast co-host Ricardo Frederick Evans, as well as Sam Fitzwater Butchart, with whom she worked when she was teaching at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The first episode of the podcast, Read More Plays, will be shared with the public this Monday, September 7th. We began our conversation, recorded Thursday afternoon, with a discussion about what COVID-19 has done to the world of performing arts and to the world of theater specifically, and how it has changed so much in the lives of Jennifer and Ricardo and Sam.
I feel like I've been on quite a journey, actually. I was a day away from going, actually the day we went into quarantine was supposed to be the first day of tech for a play that I was directing, a comedy called The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged. And the four of us, my three cast members and I, had just sort of been living together practically all day. Well, not all day, but like our rehearsals had gotten, we'd all spent so much time developing it, and then it just was gone, and it was hard. And I feel like almost everyone I know who's in the theater industry, you know, it felt like grief. You know, it wasn't just the show that I was directing that I lost, but then I had a show that I was going to work on in the summer for my theater company in New England, and that was lost. And it just seemed like, when is this ever going to happen again? And so that was really hard. But I also, one of the classes that I teach is theater history. And one of the things that I've talked about before is how the theaters would shut down in England during the plague. And so I had this, I kept telling myself, okay, it's not happening right now. But, you know, theater went away for a while and it came back. It will come. So I kept trying to give myself this pep talk of it's going to come back. It's going to come back. It's going to come back. But it was really hard. Like, I would have pictures from rehearsal that would pop up on my screen sometimes, just because my background just is on a rotate, and they would pop up, and it was just like my heart kept getting broken because I lost that show.
Mm. How about you, Ricardo Frederick Evans, based in Washington, D.C., I believe, a great theater city, as it turns out. But what is this time of COVID been like for you and some of your closest friends and acquaintances in the theater community?
Yeah, it's been very, it's been really sad to sort of see theaters that I've worked at in the past have to sort of shut down, or, you know, initially people started shifting gears and like, okay, what can we do? You know, how can we make a season work? How can we make our programming work? You know, so the great thing about it is, you know, theater has a sort of resiliency. And so you could see people shifting into sort of a virtual environment, but there's only so much theater you can do virtually. But it's been really, really hard. I know for me personally, I was in sort of a weird place anyway. So I'm very grateful that Jennifer was like, hey, I've got this idea. Because I was sort of shifting out of theater. I was kind of shifting into the real estate world, and kind of thinking, well, maybe I won't be doing theater so much anymore or anything even related to theater. So, but that was, of course, right before everything shut down. So it was kind of like, okay, now I have to personally shift gears and figure out what I'm going to do. And then all of a sudden, Jennifer's like, hey, how about this? And I'm like, you know what? I welcome it. And I really needed it. And I know for me personally, having theater and the arts being something that I have done for the last 20 years, it was necessary, I think, necessary and soul fulfilling to have something that I could look forward to, something that I could work on and share with people who are also hungry for theater.
Excellent. Finally, Sam Fitzwater Butchart, who is actually the sound engineer for this podcast, which we'll start talking about in just a moment. But Sam, what about your own theatrical roots, and what has this time of COVID been like for you?
It's been really difficult. I graduated from the University of Wisconsin Parkside right before everything kind of happened. So I was in a transitional period in my career, as it were, as well. But, you know, going from graduating and having jobs lined up and having, you know, engineering that I was going to be doing to have everything fall out from under me was really difficult, especially for the theater companies that I've been working with. I'm primarily working with three theater companies because I was in school for a large portion of the time. And watching theater companies that I've grown up with and theater companies that I've worked with for a long time not be able to perform in a traditional sense was a lot more difficult for me than necessarily the financial impact of not, or the impact of not being able to do any shows. I'm lucky enough that I was able to get a job kind of like Ricardo out in the real world, not in the theater world. So I was all right financially throughout everything. But it's been really great when Jennifer contacted me and said that, you know, I'd like your help for this project. It's really great to be back in and making art with something, especially with a very good friend of mine, a collaborator of mine for a number of years now, and their friends.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today in this portion of the morning show with Jennifer Sassaman, Ricardo Frederick Evans, and Sam Fitzwater Butchart about a brand new podcast that will launch its first episode this Monday, September 7th. The podcast is titled Read More Plays. Jennifer, it sounds like this was an idea initially hatched by you.
It was.
So let's have you begin this portion of the conversation. Tell us kind of about the gestation of this idea, and was anything in particular a catalyst for it?
It came to me kind of on several levels. I was listening to, there are a couple of podcasts that I kind of started listening to a lot, and there was something about the energy that would happen with those podcasts that made me think, I want a podcast. And that's not something I thought before this spring, but it came so clear in my head, and I kind of had this chastisement moment where I was saying, you can't just decide you want a podcast. Like, you need to have something you have to say. But I really did think first, I want a podcast. And then I very clearly thought in my head, and I want to do it with Ricardo. And but I still felt like I needed an idea. And the university that I taught at before I taught at Parkside had a policy where people had to read four plays a semester. And the idea, you know, people are always telling theater students, you need to read more plays. And professional artists always are saying, we need to read more plays. I know I need to read more plays. And it's just really difficult to make the time for it. So that was Troy University. They had a policy that you had to read these four plays a semester. And I decided it was something that the students would hand in to their advisees. So I decided that with my advisees, I would actually pick the four plays. We would all read the same four plays instead of people picking whatever they wanted. And then as a group, we would sit down and discuss it. And it, they started to turn into these little parties, and people who were other people's advisees wanted in. And so we would four times a semester just sit down and have these really cool conversations about plays. And not too long ago, in the last few years, these, you know, former students of mine who are now alumni and out working, some as theater professionals and some in other fields, somebody posted on Facebook saying, oh, you guys, you know what I really miss is talking about plays with JSAS. I wish we could still do that. And I said, I can do that. I can lead these conversations through GChat or whatever, Google Chat. I didn't know about Zoom at the time. But it actually turned out it was really hard for me to do that because my schedule was so demanding at my last job. And it just clicked. I remembered this email, how everybody wanted to keep talking about plays. And thinking about that and thinking about wanting to do a podcast with Ricardo, I just thought, oh, what if we did a podcast where we were reading more plays? Mm. And when Ricardo and I reached out, I said, hey, I have this idea. I wonder if you'd want to do it with me. And it's funny because actually both with Ricardo and Sam, I said, hey, I have this idea that I was wondering if you would work on with me. It's going to be, and they both said, yeah. I didn't say what the idea was. I didn't talk about it. They both were just like, whatever it is, I'm in.
Wow, very good. We already know the connection that you and Sam Fitzwater Butchart have, but Ricardo Frederick Evans, explain how you and Jennifer Sassaman knew each other, and then tell us about what it felt like to get this invitation from her.
Yeah, it was actually pretty amazing. Our relationship started many, 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 many years ago. We worked in a restaurant in DC together. We were both servers, and that's kind of how we met. And you know, with the way things work, life goes, you know, we separated. She went away to get her, was it your PhD? No, your master's, your MFA. She went away to get an MFA, so we separated. We randomly reconnected a couple times, actually, just whenever she came back to the city. And earlier this year, we randomly, again, reconnected in Disney in Florida, of all places. We just both happened to be there at the same time in January. And I think that's really what sort of sparked the conversation from actually seeing each other again in person, and not just like communicating through.
He froze, but I think he was going to say through Facebook and text, because that's how we mostly communicate.
Okay, very good. That's one way to, and we'll summon him back in just a moment or two.
Oh, did you lose me?
We lost you, but Jennifer finished out your thought for you.
Oh, great. Sorry about that.
No problem. So, Jennifer, explain a little bit more about this notion, and Ricardo and Sam, please feel free to join in, this notion of reading more plays, why this is something that is sort of hammered home quite often in the theater community, whether you're a theater major or just a person who's interested in theater. Why is it important for somebody to read more plays? What does one gain from that experience? And then we'll talk about how that's going to happen in the podcast. But first, just in general, even before this podcast existed, what is the point of reading more plays?
I think it's important on a lot of different levels. I think as a creating artist, you want to read plays because you want to know what you want to work on. You know, if you don't know what's happening out there, you don't have any projects that you would be excited to, you know, bring to a producing company. As a director, I have definitely sat down with artistic directors before and had them say, so what would you be excited to work on? And if you haven't read a lot of plays, your awareness, your scope of potential projects is extremely limited. As an actor, it's this, I think as an actor, as a designer, it all of that is the same. Actors have the additional burden of needing to have monologues to audition for shows. And it's hard to know what monologues you want to do if you don't read a lot of plays. I feel like the best way to figure out what you want to do is to read a lot of plays. And then also the more you read plays, I feel like you start to get a sense of how dramatic structure works and what makes something exciting and the different voices that are out there. And if you wind up writing plays, then you can identify your voice by looking at the voices that came before you. And I feel like the last big reason that I think it's important to read plays, not just from right now, but throughout the history of theater, is because everything is built on something else. You know, if you like Shakespeare but don't understand the roots that Shakespeare has in the Roman playwrights or the Greek playwrights, you are missing a little bit of insight. I don't know. I'm a total Ravenclaw nerd. I want all the insight. So
very good. Ricardo, Sam, you want to add any other points of why it is beneficial for somebody to read more plays?
Well, I think, Jennifer sums it up so well. I don't think I can do as great a job, but I think for me, having been an actor and also having directed and also having worn a bunch of different hats in theater, stage managing, producing, I think being able, and she's totally right, being able to see what's out there, being able to see what worlds playwrights have created, how they share their voices, what characters that they come up with, like all of those things are just, I feel like they're super exciting, and you don't want to limit yourself to one or two different types of things, and it's a great way to figure out what you like and what you don't like too.
Sam, anything you want to add?
No, I think that you guys got that covered. reading plays is, you know, it's where theater comes from. Theater comes from the script and being involved with multiple scripts, reading everything that you can, like any other discipline. That's where everything kind of starts.
I'm so sorry. Okay. I did just want to say that we all talked about it from the perspective of the theater student or the theater professional, but you also asked about the theater audience or the theater goer. And one of the things that I think can be helpful about reading plays for someone who is not necessarily going to be creating theater, but consuming the product of theater is, you know, if you really like, say, Denzel Washington, or you really like Meryl Streep, and there's a Meryl Streep movie coming out, you're kind of inclined to want to see it because you like that actor. If you are like me and you love Mary Zimmerman or you love Julie Taymor as like directors and you want to, and you find out they're working on a project, you're going to get excited about it. Or Lin-Manuel Miranda, like, oh, he's working on that. I love his stuff. I want to see that. If you're reading a lot of plays, you can also get a sense of what voices, as in terms of playwrights, that you like. So if you read Neil Simon or you read Stephen Adlai Gyrgyz or you read, you know, I don't know, those are two totally very different playwrights. But if you know that you like this kind of play and you find out that a company that you maybe never would have taken a chance on is doing it, you're more inclined to go out and see it because it's work that you're familiar with or you already know that you have a connection to. Hmm.
As I thought about this conversation, a couple of different real-life experiences came to mind for me. One of them was that on a couple of different occasions, I've been on the play reading committee at the Racine Theater Guild. And so that is when it's a group, and it's sometimes as large as 10 or 12, are charged with reading more plays, reading a bunch of plays and discussing them and coming to a recommendation of what the slate of plays should be for the next season at the Racine Theater Guild. And it was an experience that I really enjoyed, but I found the experience of reading plays to be exhausting. That it was, in a sense, I mean, not that it was boring, not at all, but I found it to be exhausting, much more exhausting than reading a bunch of books or reading a bunch of other articles or something, reading scripts somehow required kind of an extra level of focus and energy somehow that I wasn't really prepared for. I wonder if that's your experience as well. Is there something kind of challenging about just the act of reading a script and making sense of it that is different from reading, for instance, other kinds of literature? Or by this point, have you read so many plays that it's for you the same as reading a book?
Anyone else want to jump in?
Why don't you dive right in, Jennifer?
I always have a million things to say. Mm-hmm. My answer is, it depends. I wonder if it was exhausting for you on every play or just on the plays that were voices that didn't resonate with you. I find that if I read 10 plays in a week, which doesn't always happen, but I used to try and use my summers to try and read as many plays as possible. I'd read 10 plays and hate all of them. And then I'd hit the 11th play and was like, oh, this is so good. I am so excited about this play. I feel like plays, you know, every playwright, it has their own voice. And if it's a voice that kind of on the written page can resonate with the way that you think, then that's great. And reading it becomes easy. It becomes more challenging if it's not something that resonates with you, or it's not, it's just not a style that you enjoy. That's my personal experience.
I think the other aspect of it for me was maybe a combination of when you are reading a play and there is a very specific purpose, you're not just reading it to enrich yourself, but you are reading it and then having to think, would this work at the Racine Theater Guild? Could we do this? Would this fit into our season? And so it's a matter of a very kind of heavy, serious, high stakes kind of assessment that has to go on. But then beyond that, also the whole thing about how reading a play and then somehow part of that is imagining it on the stage. And I know that that's one of the things that you're going to be exploring in your podcast is how could this given script be given life on the stage, and what particular problems does it pose in terms of if one would actually literally produce it on the stage. And it seems to me that that adds another layer to the experience of reading something that just, you know, makes it maybe a richer but also more complicated experience.
Yeah, I know our when we do our first episode, well, that's going to be on released on Monday. I know this first play is a little bit different structurally than some of the plays that I've read before, and it sort of required an extra level of imagination. I think all the character names, they don't actually have character names, they're all numbers, so that was a little bit of a challenge. So imagining, okay, now this number is saying something, now this number is saying something, and then a lot of times they're all talking at the same time, so trying to keep track of all of the different characters was challenging. And I actually, and we'll talk about this on the podcast, but I actually was not thrilled about that. But I know Jennifer's daughter had a very, very imaginative way to solve that problem.
Well, it was my idea, but I employed my daughter's help. So the play that we're reading for our first episode is called The Wolves. It's by Sarah DeLapp. It's just a couple years old, and I'd been hearing really great things about the play and wanting to read it for a while. So I was really excited to start with this play, and I sat down to read it. It's like, here we go. And just like Ricardo said, it was all these numbers instead of names, and I was lost. It's like 8 says this, 7 says this, 46 says this, 00. And I was just like, wait, what is happening? And my daughter has all these stuffed animals because she's 8. And what I did was I asked her, I read the character descriptions that the playwright has at the start of the play. And I said, go get me whatever stuffed animal sounds like this. And she did a really good job. Like, one of the characters is supposed to have a lot of eyeliner on and be a really too cool for school character. And she brought me like the perfect stuffed animal. It even had like eyeliner drawn onto it. And one of the characters was supposed to have a lot of anxiety, and she brought me her Porg that she got from Star Wars at Disney World, and it looks very worried about things. And once I lined up these stuffed animals and I started like, okay, I'd look at the number who was talking on the play, and I'd look at the corresponding animal, and I was like, got it. And eventually the numbers became like names and I got to know who these people were, but it really definitely helped me start being able to see it.
Interesting. I think it's time for us to start talking about how you are choosing the plays that you are going to be doing. And maybe one of the first things we should ask is, are all of the plays going to be as off the beaten track and out of the ordinary as what you just described for your first one? Or is there going to be a little bit of Harvey or Our Town once in a while sprinkled in? Tell us about the selection of repertoire.
Well, I created a document while I was still at my last university of plays that it was like a present almost for outgoing students. Like, these are the titles you should be familiar with as a working artist. So it's about 10 pages long, and it's just the titles of plays throughout history. So I sent this list out, actually all three of us sent this list out to people we know who are super knowledgeable in the theater world, PhDs, professionals, playwrights, and said, what are we missing? And we really refined this list, and it's even longer now. But we're picking all of our plays from this list. That was the original starting document. Obviously, we're not doing 700 plays this season, but it does give us many seasons of plays to draw from. So we're excited to work on this project for a long time. That being said, the next thing we tried to do was we just threw out titles we would be excited. You know, Ricardo and Sam, well, actually, no, Sam's category is separate. Ricardo and I threw out a bunch of titles, and from a list of maybe 50 plays, I don't know how many we threw out that first meeting, we then started saying, okay, we want some contemporary plays, we want some mid-century, 20th century plays, we want some classic plays, we want to have plays from around the world, we want to make sure that we represent a lot of voices, so how many women playwrights can we include, how many voices of color and indigenous voices can we include, and, you know, trying to represent LGBTQIA playwrights, and really just tried to come up with a round season. And then the last thing we did when we were trying to figure out what the lineup was going to be is we launched a trailer a week and a half ago. It was just 5 minutes, but sort of announcing to the world that this podcast was going to happen and asking for other people's voices. You know, what plays would you like to see? And so we kind of put all of those requirements together and came up with the season that we came up with.
So logistically, how does it work in terms of, for instance, putting together this first episode that everyone can hear on Monday, September 7th? At what point I assume that all three of you sat down and read this play again and kind of prepared, and then at what point are you going to be reading the second play and so on? How will each of these episodes take shape?
Ricardo, you want to answer that?
Well, what was it this week that we got the play? Or you might have gotten it last week.
No, I got it this week.
Yeah, I got it this week too. I did a read through. I actually just finished my first read through today. I'm working on my second read through now. What I generally like to do is read through it just for enjoyment first, and then go back and read through it again and start to do my analysis on it. Which was very helpful, because this particular piece, I had to sort of know I had to know where it was going, and now I can go back and I'm like, all right, now things will make more sense, and now I can do all my research and look up terms or things that I might not have been familiar with. But basically, we start this week. We're gonna record this week and pass it off to Sam, who's going to work his magic on it, and it'll be ready to go on Monday.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, talk our listeners through the format of each episode. I think you've come up with a really wonderful framework.
So the format in a lot of ways is based on kind of how I would run my text analysis and directing classes, how I would talk about a new play with them. Although the very first thing we're going to do was Ricardo's idea, which I think is really fun. So the first thing we'll do with every episode is something called Hot Takes. And these are 5 questions that we're always going to answer for every show. We're just going to kind of start from here. So the 5 questions are, what do you think is the best thing about the show? What do you see as the biggest problem with the text? What is your favorite quote from the play? If you were going to work on this show, what production role would you want? And which character is the most like you? So we'll both answer that. And if we have guests on, because sometimes we'll have theater professionals come and join us, everybody who's is hosting the show will answer these questions. Then we're going to do a quiz. And this is a way, we were just going to cover the plot. Like, okay, let's go over the plot. This is what happens in the show. But I think it's more fun. Ricardo and I are going to take turns writing quizzes to try and like challenge each other. And then by answering question to question and like going from one question to the next question, we will talk through the plot of the show, but do it in like a trivia night kind of way. I also really, this is something I would always do with my text analysis students, because I knew for whatever reason, I knew not every student was going to read every play before class. Ideally, all students will read the work, but you know, things happen. People have jobs late. They don't get the chance to get caught up. So this way, you don't have to read the play to listen to the podcast. If you listen, you know, I would direct the quizzes as a way to bring people along. We went over all the answers together in class, and by the end of the quiz, whether you had read the play or not, you knew the basic structure of the plot and could then participate in the conversation. I wanted to make sure everybody in the room was could be included. So the secret of the show is you don't actually have to read plays. All you have to do is listen to the podcast and we'll tell you all about them. And I hope, you know, if people don't, I think if you read the play, this is a cool podcast to listen to because then you can be part of the conversation. If you don't read the play, this is also a cool podcast to listen to because now you're going to be familiar with a play that you wouldn't necessarily be familiar with. And maybe that'll save you the step. Like if you listen to 5 episodes and you hear 4 plays that you enjoy us talking about, but you don't actually think that's a play for you, it will help you identify that 5th play that you want to go out of your way to read. So we do the quiz as a way to familiarize everyone with the plot and challenge each other. And then we're going to do a brief analysis section. I've got a whole list of text analysis techniques as a way to kind of take a deeper dive into one aspect of the play. So we'll both talk about the technique for a split second and then talk about what that bit of analysis has revealed to us about the play. Then we're going to do a really short dramaturgy section. Dramaturgy is where you can like disappear forever, as Sam and I know we love to do deep dives. And we're not going to put all of our dramaturgy out. We're just going to say one thing that we researched that we found out that was cool. The rest of our dramaturgy and research and any words that we looked up and any music we didn't recognize and had to go listen to a YouTube video of it, all of that is going to go on our Patreon page. So if people are curious, they can become Patreon supporters and then they can have full access to our dramaturgy and our analysis and everything that we've written up. Then after the dramaturgy section, we're going to do an idea section. And this is where we really can let our imagination go wild. Like, this is who I thought would be perfect in this part, or this is the music I think would be good for the show, or this is why I think this play is a great play for right now. It's a way to talk about the artistic impulse, both that we would have or like theoretical productions we could work on. But again, if we have someone on who has a different area of expertise. So say me as a director, Ricardo as an actor, we can talk about those aspects of production, but I'm not the person you want to talk to about the costume design of a show. So, you know, we invite a costume designer on to talk about the vision that they could see for a production or any other aspect of theater. We want to have a community voices section. You know, for every episode we do, we're going to put a discussion board up on social media. So if you listen to, we did a little episode, a long trailer that we released this week, where we went through these ideas and we talked about Hamlet. And so we want to, if other people have ideas about Hamlet, whether it's about what the play is about or a vision for Hamlet, they can put that on our message board, on social media, or they can leave us a voicemail. But we want to make this not just my voice and Ricardo's voice, but the voice of our listeners too. So we want to have a section where if people are sharing interesting ideas, then we'll share them with everybody. And then the very end, the last thing is actually what I see as the end game to all text analysis, which is talking about what a play is about. What is this play about? Because I think, you know, again, using Hamlet as an example, if you say, what is Hamlet about? And somebody says, oh, it's about someone who kills his father's murderer. That's not what Hamlet is about. That is a thing that happens in Hamlet. And there I go, spoiling the end of Hamlet too. Sorry, if I'm ruining that for people. But Hamlet, what Hamlet is about, that's the artistic interpretation. And if I say that I think Hamlet is about searching for the meaning of life after you've lost one of the most profound love relationships you've ever had, I come to that after doing a great deal of analysis of the text. Like, the themes emerge when you do the analysis. And what I see Hamlet as, and what Ricardo sees Hamlet as, and certainly what Sam sees Hamlet as, are going to be different because we're going to take different things out of the text. And that's why I think it's exciting to talk about plays, but also why I think it's worthwhile to go see 7 different productions of Hamlet, because they're all going to be different, because the artists involved are going to see different things in the text.
Excellent.
And that's Ricardo, where
Ricardo, who do you envision this podcast being for? I mean, is this for people who are, in a sense, serious students of theater? Or is this also a podcast that you hope just kind of regular people who are mostly audience members and nothing more? Is this also something that you think is going to connect with them? I mean, who do you and Jennifer and Sam envision this podcast primarily as being for?
I just want to say, it's for everyone but babies.
Yes. Babies, eventually. Babies, eventually. but in present term, I think it's for everybody. Everyone who enjoys theater, everyone who enjoys going to theater, everyone who is a part of theater, whether that's, you know, you work at the box office, you stomp the boards. It's for anyone who has an appreciation for theater and theater arts.
Sam Fitzwater-Butchert, there are a whole lot of podcasts out there, and I think there are different schools of thought in terms of what a good podcast should sound like in general. I mean, should it just sound like three buddies chatting in a booth at Burger King, or should it be something that is a little more polished and prepared and, in a sense, tidy in the best sense of the word? And I mean, I think podcasts range between those extremes, everything in between. As you and Jennifer and Ricardo have been talking about this, how do you foresee this podcast falling within that arc? And what role will you play as sound engineer in terms of achieving the particular sound that you think is right for this podcast?
It's kind of a difficult question for me to ask, just because I think it's going to fall on a number of points in that spectrum over the lifetime, whatever that ends up being. I kind of come to this from maybe a different perspective than other engineers, because my background is in theater, and I've only engineered one podcast before, with Jennifer, actually, the Girl Tales podcast episode that we did together. It poses its own challenges, just from a technical standpoint, and from it's different engineering for live scenarios as opposed to engineering for post-production scenarios. So I think it's going to end up being multiple points on there. I ideally would like to make it, we talked about making it more conversational as opposed to strictly edited and tightly edited. So I think it's going to exist on multiple levels over the time. And I'm looking forward to it, to figuring out exactly how everything is going to come together.
Is there a plan that it will be recorded in a single take? Or do you see this, the various components being put together one at a time? Or is that also, are you just going to see what happens and time will tell?
So we're definitely recording it, trying to record it all in a single take as much as possible to try to keep the conversational aspect of everything going.
Sam Fitzwater-Butchert is the sound engineer, and Jennifer Sassaman and Ricardo Frederick Evans, the co-hosts of the new podcast, Read More Plays. A couple of different trailers have already been released, including one that spells out some of the plays that they will be discussing in coming weeks. The first episode is launched on Monday, September 7th. It will be available on all of the major podcast providers, including Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and Spotify. And more information is available on the podcast's wonderful website, readmoreplays.com. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, a precious interview dating all the way back to 1987. Bill Guy, the creator of this program, my predecessor as host, talking with Bob Edwards, the original host of NPR's Morning Edition. That will be tomorrow, Saturday, on the podcast edition of The Morning Show. Look for it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Monday on The Morning Show, one of the most powerful books I have ever read about race and racism. Debbie Irving's Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They have maybe closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive